Welcome to Ballistic Radio, Cincinnati's only gun talk show. Join us. We're going to explore the topic of firearms and your rights as a law-abiding citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. Now here's your host, John Johnston, on 55KRZ, the talk station.
Good evening and welcome to the Danger Zone. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. Visit them online, kylesgunshop.com. I am your host, the very silly and not very serious John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com and get the latest behind-the-scenes info at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me this evening, a veritable radio beast, the ever-excitable Andy Ulrich. Andy, how's it going?
Pretty good, John. You've had too many energy drinks tonight.
Well, I think throughout the day. And well, you're only supposed to... I've got one of the double... Let's see, how many ounces is this? This is 24 fluoro ounces of Monster Energy Absolute Zero. I'm on, like, number three, I want to say. You're only supposed to have one of these a day or you might have a heart attack and drop over and die. Anyway, none of you are listening to this show for this reason. So let's get to why you are listening to this show. Tonight we've got a really cool guest joining us, Eric Lund. He is a professional shooter for Team FNH USA. Also a federal agent. Ooh, scary black helicopters. No, he's not that kind of federal agent. He's actually a nice guy. Not that federal agents aren't nice people. Sorry. Anyway, it was funny, Andy, because I said on the Facebook page, oh, yeah, he's a federal agent, too. You know, law enforcement officer, I guess, is what I should have said.
Right.
Because I said federal agent. It was like I was having Darth Vader on the show. Why does he want to take away our guns? No, no, not that kind of.
It's not Ron Harucci.
Oh.
Come on, people.
He doesn't want to take them away. He just wants to shoot us with. No, I don't even want to go there. Anyway, I'm going to start a fight without even meaning to. What are you trying to do to me? We're going to get to Eric in just a minute, and I did have a couple updates. So, and interestingly enough, I scheduled Eric for the show way before I ever made a deal to shoot FN pistols. So just to be clear, this is coincidental. The two FNS 9mm long slide pistols showed up this week. They're going to be the new 50,000 round test pistol for this year, or it's shorter than a year, I guess, if it takes me less time to put 50,000 rounds through it. Anyway, I've only put a couple magazines through them so far. I'm waiting on a holster. I'm actually going to be driving to Pittsburgh on Wednesday to see Tom Kelly from Dark Star Gear. He's going to make me and maybe Andy some Kydex. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're special enough, Andy. Maybe. We'll see.
Don't go there.
All right. Oh, no, it'd be funny.
I'm just looking for something that doesn't twist up when I sit down.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Comtac.
Yeah. Hey, Comtac makes great holsters, just not very good appendix holsters.
Right, right. I mean, I love their SeaTac. I've got one, and it's a very comfortable holster.
So, yeah. I'm sure Eric's on the line going like, oh, they didn't tell me we'd be talking about all this stuff. Anyway, so far so good. I'm pretty impressed with the FN pistols with my limited experience with them. I'm curious to see how they run, but so far impression is favorable for what that's worth. I've got some night sights coming from Scott Warren at Warren Tactical. He's sending me a prototype set that are very similar to the Baltimore, Maryland police department's issued night sights on their long slides. Anyway, without further ado, we got 3 minutes and 45 seconds left. I timed that perfectly. Let's get Eric Lund on the phone. Eric, are you there?
I am.
Excellent. Hopefully that wasn't too silly. I apologize, sir.
No, not at all.
So for those that don't know, other than being an evil, scary federal agent, can you tell a little bit about your background and just give the listeners an idea of who you are?
Well, let's see. On the law enforcement side, I came out of college, and I was able to get hired as a Virginia State Trooper, and I worked in Northern Virginia, Fairfax County, for about 8.5 years. And then after that, I was fortunate enough to get an offer to step up to the federal level, and I took that. And I've been doing that ever since, and it's given me a lot of opportunity to do things. It's very enjoyable, and I like what I do there. And then on the competition training side. Let's see, I've been shooting competition probably since about 1994, and then I really kind of made the transition over into three-gun or multi-gun or however you want to call it, right around the year 2000. And then through my career, I was fortunate enough to have some success, and along with that success came sponsorships, and more sponsorships came along. And, you know, even though the firearms industry seems very big, the competitive shooting industry is actually pretty small. And through that process, I was able to join Max Michelle, and I shot for Team Sig Sauer for a couple of years. And when that ran its course, I was fortunate enough to have known Tommy Thacker, who was with FNH on their three-gun team. And I've known Tommy for years and years before any of us ever got good at shooting. And then we just had an opportunity, and he had an opening on the team and asked me to join, and that was about 3-4 years ago, and I've been with FNH ever since, and it's been a wonderful experience.
Very good. And you actually, forgive me if I'm wrong, you actually just won, I want to say, the Heavy Optics at Texas last year, or am I making that up?
No, I did win the Heavy Optics division at the Surefire Texas three-gun match, and then most recently, down in Florida, we had the U.S. Carbine Rifle Association, and I won the heavy division at that match also.
Nice. Well, the reason I bring that up is because it's interesting, actually, because for whatever reason, you see a lot of, and forgive me, but just, you know, I'll use terms that are commonly accepted. You see a lot of tactical guys that are very different from the competitive guys, and you're interesting because you're one of the few that bridges the gap between both worlds. I'm curious. We've got about 50 seconds left, or whatever. I know there seems to be a lot of conflict between those two sides of the gun industry, at least when you look online. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that strife exists?
Well, I mean, the two arenas are diametrically opposed. One is real-world application, and the other is a game. And there's always some battle back and forth as to whether or not the game serves any real purpose in the real world. And there's guys that live in the real world that said, oh, well, it's a game, and you'll do things, and it will get you hurt in the real world. And there's guys on the gaming side that say, well, yeah, it's a competition, but some of those skills transfer. And so there's kind of that debate that always goes on.
Okay. Well, we'll get into that just a little bit. I know you're excited, but we've got to go to commercial right now. Coming up next, we'll get Eric and myself and Andy's take on that, and then we'll get into some more interesting things for everybody else. Right now, you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. Visit them online, kylesgunshop.com. Anyway, we are talking with Mr. Eric Lund, who is an interesting gentleman just because he bridges both sides of the shooting world as far as the tactical side and the competition side. Eric, are you still there?
Yes, sir, I am.
So you were saying that before the break, I had asked you why there was such enmity between the, and I'll use the derogatory terms for both, the gamers and the Timmies. It's kind of interesting, though, and you touched on this, but, I mean, if you're solving shooting problems, whether or not you're doing that in a tactical sense or whether or not you're doing it in a gaming sense, isn't really the good thing that you're just practicing solving shooting problems?
Yeah, it depends upon what the problem is. You know, if we look at real-world applications and what we're trying to do on the competitive side, you know, the big issue that is the people on the real-world side, they look at what we do in the competition world, and they're like, oh, well, if you did that in real world, that would get you hurt. And I completely agree with that. But what I will say is the skills that we develop in the competition side translate to the real-world side. So one of my fellow trainers I work with all the time, a guy named Mike Seeklander, who's got a couple of TV shows, and I'm a co-instructor with him at Shooting Performance, he's very fond of saying that there are competitive applications to combative processes. And having competitive skills that you can take and apply to a tactical situation, I think, is how you bridge those two worlds.
Right. And for those that don't know, we've had Mike on the show, and he's actually a really good guy. Mike is a former federal air marshal, so he knows a little bit about the tactical side of things as well. The reason kind of why I went this direction, I was having a conversation with a listener before the show about he had a couple questions that he wanted me to ask you, and they weren't going to really translate that well just because of what the questions were. But he's kind of amongst the crowd that is more on the competitive side of things. So I thought it would be an interesting direction to go. Now I will kind of switch directions and all that. So you instruct a lot of people, and I've talked to several very well-known instructors, Todd Green being one of them, who have said that you've done more to help them improve their shooting than you know, a lot of other guys. I guess my first question would be, how do people shoot better? What should they be working on? How should they do that?
Wow, that's a very
open-ended
very
question. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Very, very wide spectrum. The simple answer is, you have to identify where your deficiencies are and then begin to work on those deficiencies. Anyone can practice what they're good at. If you want to get better, you have to start practicing improving at things that you're not so good at. And that leads us down the road of developing a training plan and identifying your needs and, you know, where your deficiencies lie, because too many people go to the range and shoot, which is fun. Don't get me wrong. I'd love to do it.
Right.
But not enough people go to the range and practice. Mm-hmm. And there's a definite difference between the two.
Okay. So for the, and I hate to say this, but for the average concealed carry guy and or gal and what they maybe should be working on with a limited ammo budget and a limited time budget, what are some things that they could do to help identify what they're not good at, and then what are some things that they could do to maybe work on those things?
Well, you have to look at the environment that they expect to operate in. So when you look at a concealed carry holder, he's going to be operating in an environment where using his concealed weapon is the absolute last resort. It is, you know, he's tried to avoid, to deter, to de-escalate, to escape. He's done everything he can until he gets to that threshold where he has to employ it. So you're looking at your last resort. You're looking at dealing with threats that are going to be relatively close. You're going to be dealing with threats that are usually in some type of environment where the lighting is poor, or maybe reduced lighting situations. You're going to be in an environment where you might not necessarily have both hands free to access your firearm. And so you want to start thinking about, you know, how effectively can I operate and draw and fire my pistol one-handed? How effectively can I clear a malfunction one-handed? How effectively can I clear my garments or my concealment garment and deploy the pistol in a manner I need to? Can I deploy the pistol using my flashlight or some other type of white light, either attached to the pistol or in separate hands? So you start looking at that, and you look at, I'm going to have to do these things under compressed time frames. So we want to start saying, okay, if I don't have 200, 300, 400 rounds to go to the range, I might only have 50 rounds that I can afford this week or 50 rounds this month. I need to make those 50 rounds count. So I want to put in a lot of dry fire time, and then I want to put in live fire time that's going to make every single one of those rounds count through practice and repetition.
Okay. So for the ranges that have limitations as far as working from the holster or something like that, would you advocate just, you know, going from a low ready or something just to kind of get the gist of coming up onto a target, or how would you handle that?
Well, that's definitely a challenge. I mean, and I have been at ranges where, you know, they won't let you draw from concealment, or they won't let you draw from any type of position. They may not even let you pick it up off the table, or they may have speed restrictions, you know, one round per second.
Right.
And if you're restricted by that type of environment, then what you look at is, I can practice a lot of those draws from concealment and a lot of those skills in a dry fire setting at home, where I can work through the draw process, the steps. I can do everything I need to do except for that last shot or that last process in that equation where I actually touch, prep, and press the trigger and break that shot.
Right.
And then when I go to the range, then I can start with the pistol in my hand up it, depending upon whether you learn a four-step or a five-step draw. You know, you start in that high, ready, compressed retention position, and then you drive the gun out from what is position number three for me. You drive it out, you pick up the front sight, you know, and then you start that process right there.
Okay.
So half of this skill process is done dry fire at your house because of the limitations on the range, but then you pick up the back half of that process at the range where you can start to work on those processes.
Okay. And for the live fire, I mean, this is a conversation I've kind of had, but it's sort of just been something that's come up a little bit. As far as the live fire goes, really all you're learning at that point is recoil management and getting used to seeing visual feedback as far as to where your bullets have gone if you've not learned to track the front sight yet?
Yes. I mean, that is part of what you're trying to do.
Okay.
Guys will say, you know, do you always focus on the front sight? And I say no. I may not always focus on the front sight, but I am aware of where it's at in its relationship to the target.
Right.
And the intensity with which I focus on the front sight depends upon the type of shot I need to get.
Right.
And it's kind of it's a murky answer, but when guys ask me questions like this or when I'm training, what I basically tell people is you need to see what you need to see to get the hit that you want to get.
So learning to read the sights
is because it's different for every person and it's different for every skill set and situation.
And does part of that come up from, you know, experience in shooting that you tend to pick up more? The more you shoot, the more things that you are visually aware that you're doing, either with the gun or downrange. And a lot of people are new, just don't pick that up, but it will come to you after a while.
Yes, it will.
And it's interesting too that you mentioned focusing on the front sight. I've actually got vision issues, and most of what the shooting that I do, even at long range, would be considered threat-focused shooting. And for the newer listeners, the ones that are newer to shooting, threat-focused shooting would be you're looking at what you're shooting at, and while you might be seeing your sights in your vision, you're not focused on the front sight. Mm. And just having that visual reference can help. We'll kind of switch gears here. We've got a couple minutes before the break. I had a couple people tell me that I should really, really ask you about carbines and how to set one up and how to run one.
Okay.
And also to get your thoughts on a pistol not being a secondary weapon but being a complementary weapon.
Okay.
I'll let you pick which one you want to start with. We got about a minute and a half left.
Well, let's start with setting up a home defense carbine.
Okay. How would you do that, and what caliber would you suggest first off?
Well, calibers is a whole separate topic. So.
Isn't it? Do you want to assume 5.56/223 just to make life easy?
Yeah, let's start with that one.
All right.
And then we can progress out from there. The first thing with any home defense carbine is we have to make a few assumptions. We have to make the assumption that the base platform we start with is a well-made, reliable platform that, you know, you have the maximum amount of reliability that you can get out of that particular system. You're using good quality magazines, you're using good quality ammunition, you have, a well-built, reputable carbine. You know, if the gun doesn't go bang when you need it to, then it's worthless to you.
Right.
So we'll make that assumption that we have that. Beyond that, I think there's two items in kind of modern technology that are essential for a good home defense carbine. The first one is some type of white light. most of the time, the overwhelming majority of the time that we deploy some type of rifle in our home, it's going to be in some type of reduced light or low light situation.
All right. And I'm actually going to interrupt just real quick, and then we'll pick right back up on that. Got to go to commercial. When we get back, we're going to listen to the rest of what Eric has to say about how to set up a home defense carbine, and also, too, why the white light's so important. Right now, you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop. Visit them online, kylesgunshop.com. I was just perusing the photos of me that Andy is posting on Facebook. I don't look normal or right in that last photo, do I?
You look deranged.
Well, that's actually pretty darn accurate right there. Anyway, we are talking with Eric Lund about home defense carbines right now, and he had just said that one of the things that was really, really important to have on our home defense carbine that works and works well is a weapon-mounted white light. Eric, would you like to expand on that, please?
Well, sure. I mean, if we set the discussion of tactics about whether or not we leave the lights off on or leave turn on lights in our home, you know, we don't go down that rabbit hole. Even if there are lights on in the house, there are still areas of your house that may be dark or not illuminated. And it really comes down to you are ultimately responsible if you touch off that round. And you have to be absolutely sure that the person or the threat you're engaging is exactly who and what you think it is. You have to positively identify what you're about to do. And having that white light is critical to being able to do that. So the first thing I recommend to anyone, beyond having a reliable setup, is you got to have some type of light on that gun.
And for those people that would argue that point, I can't help but point out that there's been three or four shootings lately that I can think of off the top of my head that were either family members mm-hmm. or very, very senior Alzheimer's patients or just people in general that didn't need to be shot. They were shot because of poor positive identification of targets. Mm-hmm. Anyway, please continue.
So once we have a good light on our rifle, and the thing is, just because you have it doesn't necessarily mean you have to use it. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those accessories that I think you ultimately have to have. The second for me is I think having a red dot sight on a rifle is critical. Mm-hmm. We have newer red dot sights out there. They're durable. Batteries last for years.
You're allowed to say aim point on the sure. air. I don't mind. I mean, they don't pay me any money, sure. but they're still good stuff. So, I mean, that's all right.
All right. Outstanding. Yeah. I mean, the funny thing is I'm a huge EOTech fan.
Oh.
I actually like EOTech reticles better. My ultimate Christmas wish list was that the powers to be at Aimpoint would make a circle dot reticle.
I was actually just hoping they'd buy EOTech and make them awesomer. But, yeah, I'm actually with you on that 100%.
Yeah, but understanding that, the mechanisms of EOTech and how their sights work different from Aimpoint's, you know, the Aimpoint H1 and T1 Pros, you know, you're looking at a battery that lasts 5 years or 8 years. I mean, literally, you turn on the sight, you leave it on 24/7, 365, and every New Year's Day, you put a new battery in.
Right,
that light
right.
will be on when you need it, or that dot will be on.
Right.
And there is just very little doubt in my mind that when you look at target acquisition, bullet placement, a red dot sight gives you the speed and the precision that is very difficult to match with plain iron sights. And now we have the choice where we can put a red dot sight on there, and it makes engaging a threat faster, with more precision, and really less practice. I hate to say that, but
right.
You know, if you're smart enough and you have the ability to see the dot and you can put it on a spot where you want a bullet to go, you have some good trigger control, it's going to hit there.
Yeah. And I would assume, too, especially in the house ranges, you're a little more likely with a shoulder-fired weapon to get lucky if you have not trained. But training's always good, though, and I would suggest that for everybody. Is there anything else you think that needs to be on a home defense carbine? Or, I mean, is that pretty much it? White light, optic, you're good.
Well, along with the optics. Now, let's separate need from want.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, I think you need to have that. Because it is an optic, I do think that you need some sort of backup iron sights.
Yes.
You need some type of fixed iron sights because it's still an electronic device and it can fail. And so because of that, you still need to have some type of backup iron sights. And really one of the biggest, you know, I'll go off the reservation a little bit here. One of the biggest issues I see on the training side, on the tactical side, is, you know, I very rarely do I see a rifle come through a course now that is just iron sights. And within the training side of it, I see more and more people that are not confident and are not capable with iron sights because they've started to become too reliant upon the red dot sights. Because the red dot sights have gotten so reliable and so durable that you just don't have the failures that we used to have 5, 10, 12 years ago with red dot sights. And so now guys just don't train with the irons.
Right.
And, you know, in fact, now when you come through any of my carbine courses, there is definitely a, you know, a 2-hour block where it's, hey, dots are off, scopes are off, and we're shooting irons because it's quickly becoming a lost art.
Well, and something else interesting, too, and that brings up an interesting point. Do you think that people practice stripping an optic off of a carbine enough as far as in carbine courses or things like that? If I mean, assuming that it's a throw lever mount or something where you can actually get it off the rifle, is that something that people maybe should practice that they don't, or have you put much thought into it?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily something you need to practice.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have some type of quick-release lever, but your backup iron sights are going to be deployed immediately to deal with an immediate threat.
Okay.
If you have any type of opportunity where you have a few moments, or, you know, maybe you get that bump in the night, and when you mount the rifle or you go to pick it up, you instantly realize that the battery died or something's wrong. And it's not that actual in the moment where I need to deal with a threat immediately. And I can take 3 seconds and pop a lever and throw it off in my bag or in my pack or my pocket or drop it on the floor.
Right.
Because at that point, it's worthless to me.
Okay.
So while I don't see the need to be able to remove the optic fast, I do see the need for the ability to remove the optic without any special tools or wrenches or anything like that. So,
okay.
So yes, I would recommend some type of quick throw lever that I could get it off if I need it. But to actually try to get
practice
it off
it.
In
yeah.
that moment,
yeah.
that's not really a skill because you're going to deal with a threat either
one way or another.
Either with, you know, what we term, you know, optic failure drills, where I just continue to use the circle of the optic itself as a sighting device, or
right.
I will deploy the backup iron sights and, you know, solve my problem.
Okay. So we've got about a minute and 20 seconds left in this segment, and then we get to go to the other commercial. I was curious. I had mentioned at the beginning your thoughts on the pistol being a complementary weapon as opposed to a secondary weapon. Do you mind expanding on that?
Sure, but you got to tell me where you heard that.
I might have read. It's funny, you know, as much as I like to act like I'm just some doofus that gets on the air and just has no plan or anything like that, I do read up on the guests before they come on. So if you can guess, I'll tell you.
Well, I know probably you either heard it from another person that I train with or you read it in an article in Recoil.
Not Recoil, no. Actually, Chief Weems, his blog, which is a really, really underutilized and appreciated online reference for things that are cool to learn about. But,
Yeah, well, I had actually, an issue or two ago, I had written an article for Recoil magazine about that very topic.
See,
and,
I'm like slacking because I write for Gun Up and you know, the Recoil's cool and I'd write for them too, but they haven't contacted me yet, so... I'm behind on my magazine articles that I should read. But hey, it's funny, we actually discussed this right up until the break. So when we get back, how about we talk about your thoughts versus complementary versus secondary weapon? So
outstanding.
All right, perfect. When we get back, we'll hear Eric's thoughts on that, and maybe we'll make some more inside jokes that no one else will understand. Right now, you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown. Visit them online, kylesgunshop.com. Anyway, we were trading inside jokes before the break. We have Eric Lund on this evening talking about all sorts of cool things related to his more experience than mine in the shooting industry, mm-hmm. and or being awesomer than me. Whatever. Most of the guests are awesomer than me. Anyway, wow, that went poorly. Eric, are you still there?
Yeah, I am.
Some of my intros are better than others. In fairness to me, I was doing laps between the studio and the producer's booth just to check on something, so it distracted me slightly. Anyway, I had asked you about the difference. I guess you consider a pistol to be a complementary weapon as opposed to a secondary weapon. Do you mind expanding on that, please?
You first have to create, you know, whatever situation is out there where you would legitimately have two firearms, you know, either law enforcement, you're in the military, you're doing security contractors, you know, whatever that situation may be, you have two weapons with you. You have your primary, which is a rifle, and then you have a secondary or backup, which would be, you know, your pistol. And traditional training through the years and most schools I've ever been to, if you have a primary, that's what you want to fight with. It's more powerful, more rounds, you know, easier to shoot, a whole host of reasons that you want to stay with the rifle. And that the pistol was always viewed as, well, when my rifle breaks or if my rifle breaks, then I go to the pistol and I have that as a backup weapon. And I've kind of always looked at it a little differently. I looked at the pistol as a separate tool in my toolbox. It has certain purposes. There's certain things that the pistol excels at over the rifle. And so I started to use an approach where the pistol was a complementary weapon, not an emergency weapon. And by that, I mean gunfighting is problem solving at speed. You know, you have certain tactical problems that you have to solve. And when I would encounter a problem, I mean, you know, we met each other at SHOT Show for the first time this year, and, right. you know, you're like me. I mean, we're big guys.
Yeah.
And when you start putting on body armor and you start putting on kits and you know, chest plates and harnesses and rifles, you know, it's tough for me to fit through a doorway normally.
Right.
You know, and then when you gear up and kit up, things get a lot smaller.
Yeah.
And crawl spaces get tiny and closets and bathrooms and certain corners and things become a little bit more difficult to maneuver.
Right.
And so one of my big positions that I put out to my students is don't fight for a bad position. Mm-hmm. In that, I mean, if you have a confined space or a tough angle or you're having an issue getting a rifle, a muzzle, in a direction that you want to get because you think there's a threat there and you're not clear, rather than take an overexposed or a slow exposure or a bad position because of the confined space, I advocate making sure the rifle's on safe, voluntarily slinging the rifle, pull out the pistol. The pistol gives you more maneuverability. It gives you the ability to operate better in a confined space. Now, I'm trading some power and magazine capacity, but for this particular problem, I can now solve this problem faster and more efficiently with a pistol than I can with the rifle. And then once that particular problem is solved, I've cleared that area, or I've dealt with whatever I need to, I can then put the pistol back in the holster, redeploy the rifle, and move on to my next tactical problem that I have to solve.
Okay. Do you
and
think
so? I take that approach that those are two separate systems that complement each other, not a primary and emergency only secondary.
Okay. Do you think that shooters in general tend to fixate on one specific tool that they have available to them, and that's why you don't see more instruction that is similar to that, as far as, you know, slinging a rifle when voluntarily slinging a rifle and going to a pistol?
I don't know if fixation is the right word. I just don't know if it's something that mentally, you know, in the training industry, there's just a lot of it. I just don't see a lot of other instructors that really, really espouse that.
Right.
You know, and, you know, we can sit down and discuss the merits of that tactic or that technique over a beer anytime, you know, and I'm sure there's pros and cons. It's just, I just don't see a lot of people espousing that position and using it as such because, you know, rifles are getting smaller and smaller. You're seeing guys running true M4s with the 14.5-inch barrels with
right.
flash suppressors mm-hmm. and collapsible stocks where it's fully collapsed. And, you know, now even you're seeing more and more the short barrel rifles. People are getting the Title III's and the SBR's. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, and you I personally got an 11.5-inch Knights armament that I actually use. Hey, we got a caller real quick. Eric, do you mind taking a question from one of the listeners?
Absolutely.
All right. We've got Rick from Oklahoma, who, if it's the same Rick that I think it is, always has good questions. Rick, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine, John. How about you?
Hey, not too bad. It is the same Rick that I was thinking of. What's your question for Eric?
Hey, Eric's talking about transitioning from handgun to long gun and back and forth. What kind of thing is he using to do that with?
What kind of sling is he using to do that
with? What kind of sling,
Eric?
Oh, okay. For slings, I'm a big proponent of two-point slings, and I go back and forth between the Viking Tactics sling by Kyle Lamb, and also recently I've been working with the Larry Vickers sling that he runs also from Blue Force Gear, and I do like two-point quick adjustment slings.
Yeah. Yep. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Yeah, sure does, John. Thanks.
Hey, no problem. I'll talk to you later, Rick.
Okay.
Take it easy. So, Rick is actually got a chance to shoot him in the face with a airsoft gun out in Oklahoma. And we've been friends ever since. So,
when do I get to shoot you in the face?
Nothing says friendship like that.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, I actually think I shot him in the teeth. That might have been someone else. I couldn't remember. Anyway, so going back to that, I guess we've got. We got a couple minutes left before the show's over, and all that. So you do get a chance to give instruction when you're not, you know, doing your day job or shooting for FN. Is there an easy way for people to track down your schedule and or get in touch with you if they want to take training with you?
Sure. Really, the best way is to go through Mike Sieglander's website, which is theshootingperformance.com. We host our courses up there, and then you can also get with me or, you know, friend me on Facebook, and it's just, you know, Eric Lund, and, you know, just do a quick search for me and I should pop up, and then I teach classes locally here.
Yeah, the shooter, not the rugby player. Don't get confused. And it's Eric with a K, just to be clear.
Yes, it's my good Norwegian heritage. I am a K, not a C.
I was going to say it's very Viking of you, which is not too far of a stretch. So we got a couple minutes left. Out of curiosity, I'll throw a curveball at you. If there was one thing that you think that people do not give enough thought to that they should perhaps be giving thought to, as far as shooting goes or self-defense or anything at all, what do you think that would be?
I think probably the area that people put the least amount of effort into is being prepared for the fight after the fight, you know, the post-shooting processes that you're going to go through. And I don't mean that in the, well, you know, I've engaged this threat, I'm scanning around, I'm checking my weapon. I mean, do you have a lawyer? Do you have a card? Have you gone out and gotten with an attorney that specializes in self-defense cases? Have you sat down with him and said, here's my concerns, here's what it is, how do I contact you? You know, how do I contact you on non-business hours?
Right.
So it's 3 o'clock on a Saturday morning, or it's early Sunday morning. How do I get in touch with you? What's my contact process?
Are you saying that 3 a.m. on a Sunday morning is not a good time to be looking for a lawyer after you just greased a dude in a Walmart parking lot?
It probably isn't, you know. And one of the things that I push out there is you need to be prepared that if you end up using that level of force, you need to be prepared that you're going to be arrested, you're going to be handcuffed, you're going to be photographed and fingerprinted, you know. And I'm not saying that that's going to happen in every case, but you need to be prepared that that does happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because in that instant, before you touch off that trigger, that is not the time to be worrying about, am I going to get in trouble? Am I going to get arrested? Is this the right thing to do? You've got to know all this ahead of time and have it planned out, ready to go.
And it's so funny you mentioned that, the not being worried about that. I can actually, and I don't remember which mall shooting it was, but there's actually a guy that's paralyzed from the waist down now because he took a rifle round because he didn't shoot the active shooter because he was scared that he'd get in trouble for shooting a guy in the back.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Whoops.
You know, and the tactics of that is a different question,
right,
or a different topic we can go down. But, you know, if you take your if you take it seriously that you want to carry a weapon for self-defense,
find
and
a lawyer.
You need to take all of it seriously, not just the shooting. I mean, we like shooting; it's fun. We go out, we practice. We like guns. We're gun guys.
Right.
But if you're gonna be serious about that, then you need to have that business card of a lawyer, not just in your wallet, but up on the refrigerator at home. So
right.
as you end up getting put in the car, your wife or your mm-hmm. girlfriend or your brother or somebody, you can say,
"The card is on
the refrigerator. Go call the lawyer."
Hey. Hey, I appreciate you joining us tonight, man. We got to go. It's the end of the show. So thanks for joining us. You enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Hey, no problem. Next week, we're going to be talking with William April about all things violent criminals. Make sure you check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/ballisticradio. Tune in, ballisticradio.com. Thanks for listening. See you next Sunday, 7 p.m.